Thank you again for everybody joining, and I am going to ask Alma to begin the presentation.
Thanks, Nicole. Good morning, everyone. The purpose of today's presentation is to briefly go over the guidelines so that you better understand what's expected for a good proposal. Slide 2. These are the topics we will cover: overview, grant types and amounts, threshold criteria, ranking criteria, preparation tips, resources to help you, and then we'll answer questions. If we move too fast for you or you need more in-depth information, I would encourage you to attend the half-day workshop throughout September, one of the half-day workshops throughout September. September 9th, St. Louis in the afternoon. September 15th, Salina, Kansas in the morning. September 16th, Springfield, Missouri in the morning. September 23rd, Ames, Iowa in the morning. And September 24th in Lincoln, Nebraska in the morning. Slide 3. Brownfields is a collaborative and voluntary process with state partners as leads through their respective voluntary cleanup programs. Brownfields is designed to empower you to assess, clean up, and reuse brownfields, and we have grants to help you with that. Slide 4. So what is a brownfield? A brownfield is that abandoned site that you might that you think might be contaminated, and it's that thinking that hinders expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of it. Buyers pass it up. Real property covers the land and the building, includes interior asbestos, lead paint, molds, or meth-like residues, without the need for a potential release of contaminants into the environment. It doesn't have to be contaminated. Remember, it just has to be suspected. Slide 5. These are the types of contaminants that are covered by this funding. Slide 6. There are numerous benefits to assessing, cleaning up, and redeveloping brownfields, a number of which are listed here. Primarily, it will help your community transform properties from underutilized or abandoned locations to those that meet the needs of the community, be it an inviting river landing as shown here, a community center, housing, or a new business. All of these will have health, aesthetic, financial, and emotional benefits, such as a cleaned-up petroleum leak or contaminated building, an inviting entrance into your community, increased revenues, and a sense of pride or place for community members. Slide 7. The Brownfields program has had a tremendous impact on communities and people's lives, from thousands of properties assessed and many cleaned up, billions leveraged in investments in transforming these properties, and thousands of jobs created. Slide 8. This is an example of the Brownfields program making a difference in Omaha, Nebraska. A former plating company was transformed into much-needed parking for Creighton University, contributing in a small way to education of young minds. Slide 9. This funding is authorized by Congress under the Brownfields Law. We fund the states and tribes to work with you to get things done. Items in orange and the first one in yellow are competitive, and the last two are non-competitive. All the grants we offer have annual competition. The next annual job training competition is expected to be announced very shortly. The current assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants competition was announced August 12, 2009. Slide 10. Brownfields cooperative agreements cover costs to assess, clean up, and develop revolving loan funds to issue cleanup loans and subgrants. They're often referred to as 104K grants, competitive grants, or pilots if they were funded prior to the Brownfields Law. Slide 11. It is an extremely competitive process. And these are the figures for the recent competition. In 2009, due to the additional stimulus funding, a little over one-third of the proposals submitted were actually funded. That percentage is typically a little lower. What you are likely more interested in is how Region 7 proposals did. Well, for Region 7, we had 18 of the 44 proposals that were selected for award. That's roughly 41%. Clearly, what we need in Region 7 is more high-quality proposals for a bigger piece of that pie. Slide 12. Here are the key dates to remember. October 16, 2009 is when the proposals are due. Especially if you plan to submit your proposal electronically, we would like to encourage you to aim, I'm talking aiming here, to submit it 2 days in advance. People wait till the last minute and then there's electronic problems and you may not get your proposal in on time. They have to be submitted by that deadline. Slide 13. This is the website for the guidelines. There are separate guidelines for assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan funds, so be sure you print the correct ones. Start right away by printing and reading them carefully, highlighting key points, flagging key items that must be provided, underlining those ands and circling those ors so that you don't miss anything. Start early so you can be prepared to finish writing a complete proposal a few weeks early, in time to share with an editor, the state, a successful applicant, your partners, any pair of fresh eyes that can help improve your proposal, and take your proposal from complete to great and hopefully selection. Slide 14. Listed items are covered by an assessment grant. Note that cleanup planning is covered. If you get that done as part of assessment, you will be better prepared for applying for a cleanup grant or having more complete information for investors to make informed decisions about the property. You have three routes to choose from: community-wide, site-specific, or coalition. For community-wide, you can apply in two separate proposals for petroleum and hazardous, or one combined proposal for both in the amounts listed. Slide 15. For site-specific proposals, they are typically $200,000, but if the site is sizable or significantly contaminated, you can request a waiver for up to $350,000 per property. Only one site-specific application is allowed per entity. Remember, threshold requirements must be passed, and Bob Richards will be covering that shortly. Slide 16. Assessment coalitions consisting of a minimum of three eligible entities can apply for up to $1 million for hazardous and or petroleum funding. You must assess at least five sites. Coalition members cannot apply the same year for site-specific or single-entity community-wide proposals. Slide 17. Let's go over assessment grants again with this table as a visual aid. Coalitions can submit one proposal for a maximum of $1 million. If not part of a coalition, you can submit two or three proposals, depending on whether they're community-wide, bundled or not bundled, for up to a maximum of $400,000 in community-wide assessment, and a $200,000 site-specific for up to $350,000 with a site-specific waiver. There are two paths for community-wide proposals. Path one, you can submit one proposal for a maximum of $400,000 to address hazardous substances and petroleum, at up to $200,000 for each substance within the same target area. Think of it as a bundled application. Path two, you can submit two separate proposals for a maximum of $200,000 each to address either hazardous substance or petroleum. Slide 18. Here are before and after pictures of what used to be an automotive facility that had releases to the environment and was a public nuisance in a Hispanic neighborhood in Kansas City, Missouri. It was cleaned up and converted to a public library serving the needs of the community, promoting minority reading and education, a gathering place for the Hispanic community, and meeting spaces for the general public. Slide 19. Here's a success story in Pittsburgh, Kansas. A MineStar land property was converted to green space and the new location for a much-needed Home Depot in the community. Significant quantities of smelter waste and contaminated soils were removed, and portions of the property were capped. Slide 20. For the fiscal year 2010 competition, existing RLF grantees cannot apply. The requirements are the same for RLF as in the past years. Slide 21. This is a success story in the third ward of one of the poorest minority communities in St. Louis. A former manufacturing site with petroleum and lead contaminated soils was cleaned up and converted to senior housing. It took roughly a $70,000 subgrant, including a $17,000 cleanup match, and $4.5 million in redevelopment leverage funds. Slide 22. Okay, listen up for a major change this year. For a cleanup grant, the entity applying must have fee simple title by the proposal submittal deadline. If this becomes problem, there is no change on this, but we do want to be aware if this is going to cause a problem for your community, and we need to hear from you by you sending an email to the Brownfield coordinator that's listed in one of the appendices in the guidelines. The requirements are otherwise the same as last year, highlighting a few. $200,000 maximum per site and up to 3 properties with a separate proposal for each. And this very key item, community notification, must be completed before submittal to task threshold. That's a notice of intent to apply, request for comments on the draft proposal, a public meeting to discuss that, and a summary of the comments and the response to comments. Slide 23, another success story in St. Joseph, Missouri. I toured this building. It's a lead-based, it had lead-based paint, asbestos, hydraulic fluids, and a petroleum product contamination, and it was a very dilapidated building, which was converted to the Heartland Foundation building. The beauty of the finished space is surpassed by the benefits to the community, a gathering space for at-risk youth to have access to resources, plus receive training and leadership skills that they then use to conduct projects to the benefit of their community. Cleanup, in this case, paid for the asbestos-impregnated material roof to be removed because it was collapsing and it was creating a safety hazard. It's also near a bus transit system, and the $200,000 cleanup was leveraged into $10 million of redevelopment. Slide 24, another summary chart for you. I won't belabor that. I think we've discussed those significantly. Slide 25, websites for the job training grants program and the targeted brownfields assessment program. You might want to consider supporting a training organization training local residents to work at your ARC-funded brownfield site, so you might suggest to them that they look at those guidelines and possibly apply. If you don't want to apply for an assessment grant, getting EPA to do an assessment in your community might be all that you need. Slide 26. Now I will turn it over to Bob Richards, the Region 7 Brownfields attorney, who will cover threshold requirements.
Slide 27, please.
It's just a little slow.
Okay. This is going to be an overview of the threshold criteria, and in a competitive process, all of these applications have to pass these threshold criteria or you don't go forward. So we should be on slide 27 right now. We have certain statutory requirements, and then there's some policy eligibility requirements also thrown into the threshold criteria. The process, though, as I indicated, is a pass-fail analysis for the threshold, and failure means it will not be forwarded to the national competition. We can assist you in some of this preparation, particularly on the site eligibility issues, but also do not fail to rely upon your states, because your states will be a partner with you in a number of matters for the preparation of this proposal. Number 28, please. This covers what we, or just as a list of the items that we will be covering in my segment here. And I will notice, I want you to sort of follow along and focus on the type of grant that you will be seeking. And if you'll notice at the bottom of each of these slides, there's a cross-reference to either the assessment booklet, the RLF booklet, or the cleanup booklet, which are the separate booklets for the proposal guidelines. Slide 29. On the applicant eligibility, this applies to all of the applications. There is some slight difference on the cleanup grants only that will accept not-for-profits, but generally these are going to be governmental units, local governments, states and tribes, and some quasi-governmental entities such as redevelopment authorities, port authorities, and so forth. Slide 30, please. On this slide is just sort of a rehash of what Alma covered. as far as the three or more coalition members, two or more coalition members for an RLF, they have to be separate legal entities and include in the proposal a documentation that they are these eligible entities and that they've agreed to be part of the coalition. Slide 31. As I said before, the state or the tribal environmental authority will be your partner here, and it is a requirement that they provide a current letter acknowledging that you are applying for this particular grant. The petroleum determination is an additional letter that we'll be covering later on, and if you are applying for multiple types, you can have the same letter, but you need to make sure copies are included because, as we indicate, if they pass the threshold, they are copied, they go to a national competition where you have a panel looking at these, and so you need to have sufficient copies. Your state and tribal environmental authority needs to be in on this early. They should be in on it right now so that they can be assisting you and getting you these required letters. Next slide, number 32. All of Gaul is not divided into three parts, or all of Gaul is divided into three parts, but for these types of grants, we divide it into hazardous substance sites and petroleum sites. Some of the rules here. Hazardous substances are mixed petroleum hazardous substances where they're mixed together. And it's not petroleum, and we make a decision whether or not it is a hazardous substance site. It does not have to be released into the environment, so we can cover indoor asbestos, indoor lead paint. Petroleum sites are where it's predominantly petroleum. The state will be issuing a petroleum eligibility letter on these. Next slide, number 33. In this, the non-tribal petroleum site applicants have to provide answers to certain petroleum threshold questions that's included in your application, but you provide that to the state because we need the state's letter also, because the states have greater experience than the feds do in addressing petroleum sites. These have to be sites that are relatively low risk, there's no viable responsible party, the applicant's not responsible, and it's not under a corrective action cleanup for the petroleum. Next slide, number 34. Alma's slide had a definition of what is a brownfield site, and like the hearsay rule, it's easy to know what hearsay is, but knowing what the exceptions are is a difficulty. So the exclusions. There is a list, and these are sites that are never going to be eligible. You can't go for the add-back, as we call it. And these are sites that are high-risk NTL sites, sites that are already under a cleanup order under Superfund or the CERCLA law, and federal properties. Next slide, number 35. Now, there are some sites that are initially excluded, but we can accept them back with a property-specific determination. If you have one of these properties, we want you to talk to us early on in the process because this is an eligibility issue that we can perhaps assist you on or maybe give you a determination informally as to whether or not this site is going to qualify. And these are sites that are under cleanup orders under non-Superfund statutes, certain petroleum sites that have already been cleaned up under the trust fund site but might have additional cleanup or assessment work in order to be productive, and sites that are the subject of a planned or ongoing removal action. Those are basically very quick actions under Superfund, but there may be something that we can coordinate with you for that type of enforcement action versus this grants program action. An ineligible site is going to have to pass certain criteria, and that is it's going to be based upon the protection of human health and the environment. We're still an environmental agency, not just a grants agency. It's going to promote economic development or the use of green space. Next slide, number 36, please. There's another site-specific assessment and cleanup applicant's concern here, and that is that the brownfield law has what is called the general prohibition. It harkens back to the original beginnings of the Superfund or CERCLA law, polluter pays principle, and that means that we are not giving grant money to people to pay for a problem that our enforcement program might otherwise assess against the applicant. It's a very broad liability under Superfund, and one of those is ownership liability, so it's necessary that you not have liability. Yet for the cleanup grants, you have to own the property, so you have to own it the right way. Next slide, number 37. As I had indicated, for cleanup grants, you have to own the property, and this is probably where we run into difficulty. You have to own it by fee simple, and that means it's yours. It's not a contract to purchase, but you have the deeded property to you. If you have something less than a warranty deed, like a quitclaim deed or some other type of deed, talk to me early on. Contact Alma or others in the Superfund program, the contacts, so that we can get the message to me and we can figure out maybe a way to solve this issue so that you can be eligible by October 16th. And that's a very tight time frame. If you have a difficult property, let's get to work on it later today. This ownership recognizes sort of a redevelopment cycle that you've identified the property, there's an assessment grant, followed by a cleanup grant, a partnership, and perhaps a community benefit, either green space or a new construction on the property. And this utilizes all of the elements of the brownfield law, which I won't go into detail right now. Next slide, number 38, please. The most common, number 30, it's coming up here. There we go. The most common acquisition scenarios for grantees, because most of you are going to be governmental entities, you have these powers, is tax foreclosure, eminent domain, or you buy it. If it's donated, it's the same as if you purchase it. So that used to be a common misconception, but I think as people are more sophisticated, they know that that's still a purchase. You have to meet one of these Superfund defenses to liability, and that's there are tax foreclosure, eminent domain, and we can talk about those. The innocent landowner defense or contiguous property owner, these are going to be properties that you probably have acquired and have been holding for some time. But for newly acquired properties, the things, the development projects that you're working on now, the gold standard is try to qualify as a bona fide prospective purchaser under the brownfield law. Next slide, number 39. The BFPP has two threshold criteria, five continuing obligations, and the principal document is the Common Elements Guides, and that is available on the web at the EPA website identified in your proposal guideline booklet. It only applies to acquisitions after January 11, 2002. For grant purposes, however, if you acquired it earlier and you went through all the steps of the liability defense, we'll still qualify you for the grant, even though technically you are not a BFPP. Next slide, number 40. The threshold criteria basically are that you did not cause a contamination, you're not affiliated with somebody. The instances that this comes up with are where it's a municipal landfill, generally, is how it occurs, or a municipal garage where there might have been hazardous substances released, fluids and so forth from the business operations of that facility. And the second criteria is that this all-appropriate inquiry, and we'll be talking about that further, is conducted prior to the acquisition. Let me repeat that. Before the acquisition, prior to the acquisition. That is the most common mistake, is that they acquire the property and they do the all appropriate inquiry afterwards. Next slide, number 41. What standard applies? And this is just sort of a historical artifact based upon the passage of the Brownfields Law. There was a prior practice, then there was the Brownfields Law, which incorporated the existing ASTM standards, and then EPA developed a rule and adopted or approved a standard at the same time. And each of these, you sort of have to keep a library if you're in a city development office, because you may have a property that the city acquired one way or another from either before 97 or all the way up to yesterday, and you have to figure out which standard applies. And they do have subtle differences, and if you have a question, call me, we can go through those. Next slide, number 42. For the cleanup applicants, you have to have a particular property identified, and you have to be owning that property by October 16th. That means that if you're qualifying as a BFPP, you have to have had that phase one up, and it must be current. It has a shelf life, so if more than 180 days have passed before you accepted that deed, you may not be compliant or up to date. Also, as a policy matter, EPA requires that you have a phase two site assessment completed prior to the proposal submission in order to describe the cleanup plan and estimated cost. And this is just a policy matter. It's in order for the grants to be, I guess, have some reality testing on them, to have that phase two under your belt. Next slide is number 41, please. 43, excuse me. One of the requirements as threshold is a commitment that you're going to do the cost share for those grants that require it, the cleanup and the RLF. They're not required for the assessment grants. There is a 20% match, and as you can see, the mathematics of it is it's a $200,000 grant. That means you have to show or commit to $400,000 a match. It's a plan. You don't need to exceed the required amount. But do know the difference between leveraging and match. The match has to be eligible and allowable expense. That's a federal grant cost principle. Leveraging could be something else. You could be writing a description of your project in which Hilton Hotels is going to build a hotel on top of your building, and it's going to bring so many jobs to the area, but that would not be an eligible and allowable expense. Hardship waivers are in the brochures, and there are instructions on how to request them. And if you are a community that can't meet that match, you can demonstrate or meet it by asking for a waiver. The cost share can be passed on to a borrower in an RLF. That would be a situation where you're going to loan money and you're going to have a development, but they're going to agree to spend on eligible and allowable expense related to the cleanup. That's a mouthful. Let's go to the next slide. This one's a nice slide. Okay, provide a description of jurisdictional boundaries. Easy as cake. Next slide. Cleanup and legal authority for oversight for the cleanup and the RLF applicants. For the cleanup oversight, describe how you're going to oversee the cleanup, because there are certain requirements for human health and addressing the risk. And I encourage you enroll in a state or tribal voluntary response program. They give you the clean letter. It's going to enhance the value of your project anyway. Property access, if you need to get adjacent or other properties, neighboring properties, describe how you're going to get that. Normally, you already have these under your belt. Legal opinion for the RLFs, that you basically have the authority to secure the sites and to manage a RLF. Most communities already have this in the various other programs that they've managed funds, made loans, and followed the federal rules for cost accounting on that. The RLF coalition applicant, you have to have a broad jurisdiction and authority to ensure the program performance of the members, borrowers, et cetera, if warranted. Next slide, number 46. This is important and a requirement that you need to step on right away this afternoon if you haven't already done that. Provide the community notice of your intent to apply for a grant. If you have more than one grant, it can have a single notice, but you better notify all targeted communities of each proposal relevant to their community. This is important for the cleanup grants. Next slide. Okay, cleanup grant applicants, place an ad in your paper that covers the area at least 2 weeks prior to October 16th. So we have an October 2 deadline, okay? And we want to see that and prove it. Otherwise, it's a pass-fail, and it's sorry for you. It has to communicate that the proposal is available for public review, that you're going to accept comments, and that you're going to be holding a public meeting that you have to hold prior to this October 16th date. So see page 19 on the cleanup booklet for the necessary attachments, but as the little yellow tag says, this is an urgent thing, okay? And that concludes what I have been assigned to cover, and so we're going to pass the microphone on to
Good morning. Jim Seiler and I are going to tag team the overview of the ranking criteria. Where appropriate, we're going to try to provide cross-references with the guidelines and just some general overview tips. Reviewers for the ranking criteria will not be from Region 7, with the exception of one sub-criteria under the programmatic capability, and we'll get to that in a moment. But your reviewers for the ranking criteria are going to be EPA and other federal partners from other regions and from EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C. So they don't know anything about your community or your project. So just start from that frame of reference that you need to explain yourself well in your responses. Make sure that you remain consistent in your description of your targeted community and the socioeconomic conditions of that community, and carry that out through your responses to the ranking criteria. And just do a good job of telling your story, because as Alma pointed out early on in the presentation, we only funded roughly about a third of the proposals that we received. So it's highly competitive, and you need to tell your story for why your community deserves to be funded rather than other communities. Moving on to slide 50.
As Stephanie has indicated, once it reaches the ranking stage, it has passed the threshold criteria. On this page, you'll see the four ranking criteria listed, and we'll now go into each one of them in greater depth. Slide 51. Remember, each criteria is made up of sub-criteria. The weighting of these varies, so it is important to answer each one individually. Also, if you intend for an answer to apply from somewhere else in your submission, make sure you reference that location so it is not overlooked. Don't take for granted that you answered it in one place and people will give you credit somewhere else without making the reference. Also, note that all of the proposals, all the grants types are 100 points.
On slide 52, the first criterion under the ranking part of the proposal is community need. Note that for assessment, the total possible points for this criterion are 20, 15 points for RLF and cleanup. So especially for the assessment, this forms a significant portion of the total, the 100 points that you'll receive. When you respond to these sub-criteria, be sure to give clear references for the information that you provide. Where it's appropriate, provide information in tabular form to make sure that it's clear. Help the reviewers to understand why they need to pick your proposal and explain why, but for the EPA funding, your project wouldn't go forward. Have a clear concept of what your project is all about. Please don't just say, oh, here's some federal money, let's go after it because surely we can use it somewhere. Those kinds of proposals are just not going to score as well. And so you need to think and have a clear plan about some of the properties that you're going to address and have an idea how and who are going to redevelop these properties and where you're going to get the money for it. Moving on to slide 53, the first sub-criterion under community need is health, welfare, and environment. And this criterion is asking you to provide information about the health, welfare, and environmental impacts of brownfields on your targeted community. Again, be as specific as possible about the types of sites that you need to address and what their effect is on the community. Better answers explain some knowledge of the types of contaminants that are present on these sites. For example, used oil, lead, cadmium, paint waste, and so on. To the degree that you can indicate some specificity, do so and you'll score better. Do you have sensitive populations in your community? If so, who are they and how are they affected by your brownfield sites? A good example of what this means is often in the Midwest, children have elevated blood lead levels due to exposure to lead-based paint in pre-1976 housing and also due to mining activities in Missouri and Kansas. So if that's the case, if your health department helps you identify that you have elevated blood lead levels in children in your target area, that's a good thing to state or find out what it is. Maybe it's asthma or a high rate of cancer. Just check with your health department. They're a good source for information on what the health issues are in your targeted community. Explain how your targeted community is disproportionately affected by the brownfields. In this day and age, the financial crisis has caused a lot of businesses to fail, and that leaves properties idled with contamination potentially left behind. So if that's the case, that's a good example of how you can explain that brownfields have had an adverse effect on your community.
Slide 54. I refer to the financial needs section as the facts and figures section. The financial needs of this area are an important part of the economic impact on a brownfield. Much of this is readily available from various sources, for example, the Census Bureau. Reference your data as to the source, make sure that it is current, and tie it to the story that you are telling. Use the economic downturn, the natural disasters that may have affected your area, and other issues which make financial resources unavailable. Remember, identify all information sources. Slide 55. For this criteria, there are 35 points per assessment, 45 points for RLF, and 40 points for cleanup. Remember, the story includes your approach to the project and should indicate that you have sufficient resources to complete the project. For assessment submissions, assessing is more important than inventory and planning activities. Remember that for coalitions, you must assess a minimum of 5 sites. You may also wish to denote the reference to EPA's expectations of projects funded by brownfields assessment grants as the last bullet on this slide. Slide 56. Describe the project you are proposing, and remember it is a part of the story you are presenting. If this is a cleanup, describe the cleanup plan, any required controls that may be needed, and what reuse plans are intended for your project. Slide 57. This slide is intended for RLS. It is important to describe your brownfield redevelopment program and how the grant funding being requested will be used to support the program. In addition, how much support do you have to the program? How do you plan to fund sustainability? Describe the borrowers and subgrantees and how you will reach additional potential recipients. Show staff and community commitment to the proposal. Slide 58. After many years of emphasis, it seems everyone is starting to pay attention to how important this section is and how closely this section is reviewed. The budget sets the tone for your entire presentation. It is important that the narrative for each task is present and that it spells out what is contemplated for that task. Brief descriptions, if they're not done well, may cause a reduction in points. So be specific. Don't use acronyms that someone might not understand. Remember, some of these reviewers are not familiar necessarily with brownfields before they do the reviews. Be specific. Remember, the budget will translate into your work plan if you are successful. Importantly, make sure that the costs that you present are allowable. If you plan equipment, remember that it is over $5,000, must be explained, and must be justified. Finally, the most important point is to make sure that all your numbers add up, down, across, and through it. This can lead to deductions very quickly if they are off, and they're easily ascertained. Slide 59. While this indicates that this is a sample budget format, deviate at your own risk. If you use some other format, you may suffer points loss if it is not understandable and complete. I would recommend using the suggested format. The footnotes at the bottom of the slide are also important. Slide 60. This slide shows how cleanups require the addition for the cost share. Make sure you understand cost share and how the 20% applies. Show it. Slide 61. This slide and slide 62, which follows, show the requirements of having separate budgets for loans and subgrants. Also, it emphasizes the cost share, and the total cost share matches the required 20%. Slide 62. Note the total cost share location. Also, I don't want to emphasize this too much, but recheck additions up and down, across, whatever, so that they all do match. It's amazing how these don't always turn out that way.
On slide 63, leveraging is the next sub-criterion under Criteria 2, Project Description and Feasibility of Success. In this leveraging category, we're asking you, what will you do with your money? How will you be able to fund the rest of the project? We have to recognize that all assessments don't end up with a no further action determination, and all cleanups don't cost exactly $200,000. So you have to describe what your plan is for how you're going to get the funding and the resources necessary to finish the project. And if you can explain that well, you're going to score better on this sub-criterion. Just a caveat here, if you really don't have any idea of how you're going to fund cleanup and redevelopment of your site, maybe you should consider doing a targeted brownfields assessment that Alma described earlier in her presentation of other programs. You could do a targeted brownfield assessment with the state as sort of a starter project until you gain more experience and more momentum with the brownfields program. If you step back, do a targeted brownfields assessment with the state, you can gain experience working with your state partner, gain a better understanding of what the brownfields program is about, and also get help to better develop your vision. Having past successful examples, even in the state program, and regardless of how big and how small they are, demonstrates better capability and would help you score better into the future on future proposals. On slide 64, programmatic capability is the next sub-criterion. This section is broken out into responses that will be provided by applicants who have been past brownfield grantees and those who have never had a brownfield grant in the past. For prior grantees, and I just need to say that the regions evaluate this. This is the only sub-criterion under the ranking that the regions get to evaluate their own proposals. So for prior grantees, please, 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 if you have an existing cooperative agreement, please get your quarterly reports in on time, because when we have to do your programmatic capability evaluation, if we know that you've been late on many of your quarterly reports, then we really need to be honest and deduct points for that. But we hate doing it because we want you to score well in the national competition. And a few points can make a difference between whether you get an award or not. Again, for past grantees, be sure to highlight your financial and grant management experience and the qualification of your staff. Summarize your experience with assessing and cleaning up contaminated sites, and also be sure to state, if this is the case, that you'll contract out for this expertise if you really don't have it in-house. This criterion also asks about audit findings. If you have past adverse audit findings, just be honest about it and explain what corrective action you took to remedy the situation, and you probably will lose few or no points. Moving on to slide number 65, this is the programmatic capability for non-EPA grantees. If you've not been a prior grantee, you're asked to provide no more than 5 recent examples of federal or non-federal assistance agreements that you've received and managed. Be sure to put your best foot forward on this. Even if you don't have 5, give what you have and explain. More important than anything is, if you've not been a previous grantee, is explain how you have systems and processes in place that allow you to manage grant funding in a fiscally responsible way. We want to be sure that we give grant funding to people who can track it and show where it went to, because no one wants to go to jail. Highlight your experience and the experience of your staff. And again, if you don't have environmental experience, just explain how you're going to contract out for it. And finally, again, just to reiterate, if you have any adverse audit findings, just explain what the findings were and how you fixed the situation. But the focus is on demonstrating that you're fiscally responsible.
Slide 66. Criteria 3 has 20 points for assessment in RLF and 15 points for cleanup. This is how you interrelate with the target community. How do you currently engage them, and how do you plan to continue to work with them? What partnerships have you developed, or what partnerships are you going to develop? Explain them and show the development, not just that you plan to develop with them. Finally, relate the support letters to commitments to the project by those submitting the letters. Slide 67. How is the community involved in the development of the project from site selection through the cleanup and ultimately in the site reuse planning? Where has past community involvement occurred? How is progress reported? How is language other than English or cultural barriers addressed? Explain specifically how you'll make the information available to all groups for them to easily understand it.
On slide 68, the sub-criterion under community engagement and partnerships, asking about your partnership, is trying to get you to tell us who your partners already are and who else needs to be involved in your project. You need to discuss specifically how and when you're going to involve your partners. Is it before you do assessments so that you can inform them and get property access? Or is it during redevelopment planning? Just give us specifics about what your plan is. Better Answers contain specifics of past projects, working with state and local partners, especially state voluntary cleanup programs and local health departments, and also community-based groups. Having and showing past experience working with state and local health agencies shows that you as a future grantee can hit the ground running and that you understand and know the process and have these relationships already in place. Specifically, state that you plan to enroll your sites, especially, as Bob said, the cleanup sites, in state voluntary cleanup programs. On slide 69, this subcriterion is asking about community-based organizations. This criterion is asking for quality, not quantity. The focus is on having a few key partners that have a specific role in your project. You need to include letters of support from them, and they need to be true community-based groups. You need to be specific about what their role and their commitment to your project is. Coalitions and regional planning commissions seem to have the most trouble with addressing this sub-criterion, and I think it's because they work more directly with local governmental entities and not the neighborhood and grassroots organizations. You have to find a way to establish these connections in order to successfully address this sub-criterion. Community involvement can't be just something that you state you're going to do and then you don't follow through later on.
Slide 70. Criteria 4 has 25 points for assessment, 20 points for RLF, and 30 points for cleanup. This is where the project's anticipated outcomes are evaluated. Show how your project promotes the general welfare to the target community. Be specific. Also show how it improves the safety, improves the economy, and the environment. How does it tie all of these to the overall community vision for the revitalization of the Brownfield site? Slide 71. Public health is an important element of the Brownfields program. This section is the area where your inclusion of public health departments and agencies is evaluated. How do you involve the various departments and be specific? While you may not elect to do this, if you're planning to use 10% of the grant funds for monitoring the health populations, explain how this is going to take place and be specific. Communicate the benefits. Show how you protect sensitive populations from the project's contaminants and also during the removal process. Slide 72. Demonstrate how the project will produce both economic and non-economic benefits. Be specific and quantify as best as you can. Explain the non-economic uses such as green space, parks, recreation areas, etc.
On slide number 73, I saw a lot of creative answers in the 09 competition for the environmental benefits from infrastructure reuse and sustainable reuse and the past slide that Jim just talked about, the economic benefits and green space, those two sub-criterion. I was surprised by the specificity of some of the better applicants. So keep that in focus that the other applications that you're competing with are fairly specific in quantifying these things. Can you reuse your existing infrastructure? If not, tell us why not. If so, just tell us how. How is your project sustainable? Don't tell us. I saw so many applications on the flip side of this that almost every application said, we're going to build LEED certified buildings. And I've got oceanfront property in Kansas. LEED certified buildings are expensive. The LEED certification process is expensive and it's technical. And I have a hard time believing that small communities that barely know what a brownfield is are going to build LEED certified green buildings. So with that criticism, let's focus on what are a few specific and simple things that you really could do that you could use to respond to this criterion. One really specific thing that I've seen is just the reuse of the demolition debris. If you can't use the infrastructure and buildings that are on your site, crush them up and use them to build access roads, use them as fill in lower areas. You can segregate the materials and market the demolished materials, especially the metals, for resale and use the money to help finance your cleanup. It's fairly easy to contact your county extension office, your state Department of Conservation, and also we have the K-State University Technical Assistance to Brownfields program that's available to you as a Brownfields grantee. Any of these groups could provide you technical assistance on making your project more sustainable. Another way of making your project sustainable that's easy and cheap is to landscape using native plantings and use your landscaping, design it so that it maximizes your stormwater control, maximizes the use of native plants, and minimizes the amount of mowing that you have to do. Mowing uses gasoline, and, you know, in that way you're creating an environmental benefit just with your landscaping. These are just some ideas of things that are easy to do, they're more realistic, and they really don't cost that much. So when you respond to this sub-criterion, put on your thinking cap and you know, don't just tell me you're going to build a LEED certified green building. While that's a good and admirable thing, and many of our brownfield grantees are probably sophisticated enough to do it if they haven't done so already, but be realistic if you really can't accomplish that, at least this time.
Slide 74. It is always a good idea to closely read the new guidelines and note the changes. If you're going to be cutting and pasting from previous proposals, make sure they are placed in the correct place. The criterion does move around, so see if anything has changed. Incorporate back feedback gained from previous submissions to strengthen your proposal. Don't be afraid to ask for help, but remember, sooner is better than later, especially last-minute requests. Make sure to address all the criteria, and if it doesn't apply, explain why. Don't forget that there's a checklist that you can follow that's included. As you are preparing your proposal, this is on slide 75. As you're preparing your proposal, make sure you paint an overall picture of your community and how Brownfield's funding fits into that picture. Keep in mind that the reviewer may know nothing about your community, or for that matter, even your state. Don't take anything for granted. Remember to sell the story. Avoid acronyms or organizational jargon that the reviewer may not be familiar with and may reduce points because of. Slide 76. There are formatting requirements that you must follow. Make yourself familiar with them. Some of the more important ones are like the 18-page limit, and also that does not include the 2-page cover letter. Also the 1-inch margins, 12-point font, no binders, no color. Limit the attachments to relevant information. Avoid maps and photos. If information in your cover letter is going to be used elsewhere in your proposal, remember to reference it in your proposal at the appropriate place. Otherwise, it may be overlooked or not considered. Slide 77. While bolding, underlying, and italics may be used for emphasis, it may also be both your friend and an enemy. Be judicious in its use. After receiving numerous submissions with missing pages, it is good to remind you to review your submissions for completeness before sending it in, especially after photocopying. Make sure dates are accurate on your letters. I will now, I guess this is Stephanie.
On slide 78, again, this is just continuing with the basic proposal preparation tip. During this presentation, or at the end of this presentation, you'll get an opportunity to ask questions. And due to EPA's competition policy, we can answer your questions in a public forum where everyone can hear the answers to it. You'll also get another chance to ask and hear more questions and answers in another clue-in session, which is scheduled for 10 o'clock on September 30th. So I just encourage you to avail yourself of that opportunity, or both opportunities. Ask now, and don't be afraid to, you know, let us know what your questions are. Contact your states early for the support letters and the petroleum eligibility determinations. Ask your states, and also we have, as I mentioned before, the K-State Technical Assistance, the Brownfields Program. They're available to provide assistance to you, and they're not under the same competition policy that EPA is under. So they can provide you more specific advice. And just don't call them on October 15th because, you know, at the 12th hour, they're going to be kind of grumbly about that. So be kind to them, but do go to them and ask them for help because they can even review your draft applications. For the cleanup grants, as Bob mentioned, be sure to get your public meeting set up soon. be sure that you've demonstrated that your community involvement is meaningful in the process. On slide 79, the submission process, just be sure to note that the proposals need to be postmarked by no later than October 16th. If you decide to send your proposal to us by email, the email address is provided here in this slide, and it's also in the proposal guidelines. Be sure that you've submitted it by 11:59 Eastern Time, or that's 10:59 Central Time for us. And also, just be sure to pick only one method of submittal. Don't submit it by mail and then also submit it by email at the last minute. That'll just confuse us. So just pick one. On slide 80, again, just continue with a few things about the submission process. A second complete copy needs to be sent to your regional brownfields coordinator. In Region 7, that's Susan Klein, and her address and contact information is provided in the guidelines. And finally, no faxes. Please do not send us any faxes. We've had terrible experiences with fax machines that hang up partway through transmitting the proposals, or proposals that were not even transmitted at all because the fax machine messed up. So don't take any chances. Either email it or send it by mail, and send a copy by mail to Susan Klein, your Brownfields coordinator.
Slide 81 is just that, a lead into the fact that we do have additional resources available. Slide 82. Here are the Region 7 contacts. The most noteworthy name is the person in the region to whom you will send a copy of your proposal. In Region 7, that person is Susan Klein. Her address is included in each of the guidelines, as Stephanie has mentioned. And it is in Section 7 for each one of those guidelines, just for further reference. Slide 83. This slide includes the names for the state contacts. Because of federal requirements for competition reasons, these people may provide broader assistance that can be helpful to you. I will repeat the mantra, however, that it is sooner, better than later, to contact them. Slide 84. Here and on the next page are web-based resources for your use. On this page, there are the sites for the guidelines, the frequently asked questions, the fact sheets. And on slide 85, this is a slide for Brownfields information online and smart e-tools. I will now turn it back to Nicole.
Thanks, everybody. Before we go ahead and open up question and answer section, I wanted to ask you to take a couple of minutes to fill out the evaluation form online using the link provided in your confirmation email or on the final slide of the PowerPoint presentation presented today. Please scroll to the bottom of the webpage and click on the seminar feedback form link. We appreciate all comments to help improve these sessions. In addition, again, just to reiterate that there are additional documents online when you go to the main CLUIN page for this specific workshop. Next to the seminar evaluation form on the webpage, there is also a link for links for additional resources. You can go ahead and download or open any of the files on that page. Finally, I wanted to open it up to questions. We had one question currently submitted online, so I will start with that and give everybody a minute to unmute their phones to ask their specific questions after I pose this question to the group. And I will direct all questions to Bob Richards, and he will help facilitate the answering of the questions from the Region 7 staff. And the question submitted online is that most of eastern Omaha, Nebraska is a Superfund site. Does that designation prohibit the city from obtaining a grant for work within this area, even if the list of potential contaminants does not include lead?
I'm glad you asked that question. It has come up before. It has been the Brownfields program's, policy goal that we're going to not just automatically exclude a site based upon these mega site national priorities list designations. And so to that extent, we do look at the specific work being done or proposed versus what is going on the enforcement route under the NPL site. And in Omaha, I believe that the primary concern is lead from smelters operations. And the brownfield, thus, there could be a building there that is contaminated with, say, asbestos. And you could apply for a grant, even though it is in the city of Omaha, in an area that would have been affected by the smelters. But if your proposal is to remove the asbestos from a building in order to do a cleanup, or you're doing assessment work there in particular, that we can sort of tease out a brownfields component, even though geographically it's situated at an NPL site. And also, I think that the Omaha lead site is also focused on residential properties only, so commercial properties in particular that are often the focus for your development would be something that we could consider eligible. I would suggest, though, that if you do have that kind of issue, let's call it in early and talk about it.
Thank you. I'll encourage everybody who's listening by streaming audio to go ahead and submit any questions, and I will ensure that they are read back to the speakers, but we'll open it up to those on the phone to unmute your line and pose a question back to the speakers.
Well, this is Bob. Come on, people. You need to speak up.
The overwhelming response.
I know.
All right, we'll give a couple minutes just to stay on the line to see if anybody comes up with a question. There's no harm in ending early as needed, but again, we'll stick around for a couple minutes if you do have questions. We'll also remind you that there is a second Clue In presentation that will be held on September 30th, and I believe that is also at 10 a.m. Go ahead.
I have a question. You're giving this seminar a month before the deadline. Were there previous ones earlier in the year, or with the deadline so close?
No, there haven't been yet, but when did these proposal guidelines come out in final form?
August 12th is when they were out.
August 12th is when they first came out, so we're rushing also, and I mean...
Okay, I didn't realize that the guidelines came out so late.
The closest thing to an outreach prior to this that we did, this is Alma, and I did it in the Missouri. There's usually in the summer at the Missouri Waste Coalition Conference, the Department of Natural Resources has their Missouri Brownfields Conference every year. And what I try to do, and I'm typically the speaker for that piece of it, and basically what we try to do is project based on the existing guidelines and let people know a more detailed explanation of things. But all we can do at that point is project based on the current guidelines that have already been, closed, and we're in the process of selections at that point.
And I would imagine that one of the significant changes is the community notification for cleanup and the ownership requirement.
Yes, and the revolving loan fund, requirement that if you have an existing RLF, you can't apply. We're looking for new people who haven't already received one.
And the reason for that is the existing grantees for RLF are eligible, if they're successfully operating their revolving loan fund, for supplemental funding every year without having to go through they sort of compete amongst themselves as opposed to everyone outside.
So if we can make the deadline this year, we could probably at least start on next year's and assume, hopefully, that the guidelines will be basically the same. And then once whatever changes do come out, hopefully have some time to...
They are largely similar, but you know, there's no guarantees, and I would still, I think that even if you have to work overtime, it would be better to try to get an application in this year than try to push it off to the next year, because it is only an annual for the competitive.
I would highly encourage you to prepare as much as possible and submit a proposal this year, and one of the benefits of that is it's difficult to get selected, especially for a new applicant, to get selected on the very first year anyway. And if you're not selected, there's going to be, every reviewer provides comments, their score sheets. We can't share those with you, but at the end, if you're told that you're not selected, you have an opportunity for a debrief. You will receive a letter indicating that, and you have a short window to request that debrief. I would then highly recommend that you request that immediately, and immediately submit your request, and then there'll be a short time frame that we have to be able to do those before the new guidelines come out. And during those debriefs, we actually give you detailed explanations of, we give you an idea of your scores. We can give you those by sections and your total score. And then we give you specific comments that reviewers gave you. And so even though you may not feel like you have an A product to submit this year, again, provided you have all the minimum requirements to pass threshold, if you don't get that, then it won't even go to ranking, and we can't give you those feedback as a debrief. But do the best you can now, and then you can get some feedback and be better prepared for the next year.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We did have another question submitted online, so I'll go ahead and pose that to the group and then reopen it to questions on the phone. And the question submitted online says, regarding coalition assessments, can one coalition member, which would be the lead, investigate the property of another coalition member?
I think the consensus here is yes, you can. Coalition, and I think that is one of the strengths of a coalition, is that perhaps one coalition member may have a technical or financial expertise, yet the communities are sort of all in it together, and the project would work better, but they need to sort of round up and do an area-wide project, but one party has the expertise and another party has the jurisdiction.
This can be really helpful to the very small communities that can pair off if they can convince a larger partner or a more experienced partner that has perhaps an engineer on staff that can do some of the oversight of the contractor work, that can provide some of that technical expertise. And so it's sort of, you all work up an agreement later that details how much funding is going to go where and what everybody's role is going to be. But this is where the tiniest of communities can get help from the larger mid-sized communities or those that have more staff and be able to tap into the brownfield stream.
Hey, thank you. If there's anybody on the phone that would like to ask another question, we'll open it up for a couple of minutes again.
So we just had a discussion here, and I think that we want to amend or amplify one of the answers on the coalitions in particular, where we talked about submitting an application even though it may not be your best work. Also, don't forget to use the time in the year, because, again, you may have only 6 weeks or 8 weeks to pull this together as far as the application, but as far as putting together a coalition, it takes a whole lot more legwork than that. And so if you can spend your time during the year developing those relationships, you'll be ready to hit the ground when the next year's proposal guidelines come out.
Okay. The question was also clarified online, and it was meant in terms of eligibility. Can one coalition member investigate another?
On the eligibility issues?
Yes.
That's a threshold issue, and so the applicants all have to be eligible as far as the properties being eligible. Refresh my memory. I think on the coalitions, are they only clean up, or can they be their assessment, right?
Only assessment. And EPA has to do the site-specific eligibility determination just like we do on the regular assessment.
So that's after the award.
After the award.
Yeah. And so, actually, you don't investigate for site eligibility. You basically will propose, and then we'll determine, particularly for hazardous substances. Is there a follow-up to that if I'm not been clear enough?
Yes, some sites may be named in the proposal, and that's what Bob's going to cover.
Yeah, sometimes sites are named in a proposal, and for those, again, you present the information and we make a determination. So it isn't like one coalition member determining that a site is eligible. It's just proposed and EPA makes a decision whether or not it meets the criteria.
For those less experienced folks on the line, to give you an idea, there's in the guidelines it identifies sort of the eligibility requirements. And it is eligibility of whether it can be defined as a brownfield, and then there's the eligibility of the entity. And so if you get selected to get an assessment grant, then you would submit basically an email to your project manager identifying the details about the site, and then that eligibility determination would be made on sites that are identified later.
Okay, thank you. We'll give a minute to ensure that if any further clarification needs to be submitted online, that person can go ahead and do that. We did have one other question here online that I will pose to the group, and it is, what needs to be done to request a waiver for the $200,000 limit on cleanup grants?
Stephanie will answer that.
Okay. I just blurted it out on staff with units.
For cleanup grants, $200,000 is the maximum you can receive for a specific site, and that's defined as a parcel ID number. So that sites have been sliced and diced many different ways and come up eligible, but $200,000 per site on cleanup, and that's all you can get. Now, on the assessments, if you have a site-specific assessment and the site is large and complex, you can get a waiver for up to $350,000. You just have to demonstrate the rationale for why that site requires more than $200,000 to investigate it. And I actually manage a grant for one of these sites where $350,000 was spent on the investigation, and actually more money than that was spent. So.
Just need to make a good case.
And this is Alma, I want to add a piece to that on the cleanup side. Even though $200,000 is the limit, you do have an opportunity if you have a revolving loan fund in your state that covers that jurisdiction. You have an opportunity for another additional $200,000 for that same property. But it has to be an RLF that covers the jurisdiction in which that property is located.
And we've done that too before.
Thank you. The dialogue is going to continue on that coalition question, and there was a further clarification that the issue is that brownfield assessment grant applicants typically cannot conduct phase one or two investigations of their own.
What was that, Nicole?
Hello?
Excuse me.
Can you repeat that question, please?
Yep. Sorry, I had a tickle in my throat. Okay. One sec. Okay. The issue is Brownfield. Goodness. The issue is Brownfield Assessment Grant. Applicants typically cannot conduct Phase 1 or Phase 2 investigations of their own due to potential liability of the grantee.
Okay, I think I understand the issue now. And that is where you would have a coalition where you have to have multiple eligible entities, and then you have a particular property that is a brownfield. It's not excluded as a brownfield site, but there is that general prohibition that we talked about. In other words, for one of the coalition members, that site could not be a site where they can spend money. And it has been EPA's application of the rule here, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that if it's poison for one entity, it's poison for all.
Yes. That's correct. But I will add, it's Alma again. I always know how to sneak out another way. You then come in for funding under TBA. Request for EPA to do the assessment of that property for you, for your state or whatever them. Yeah, it's either EPA or the state. But you can still get it assessed only through the targeted brownfields assessment, not through your grant funding.
If requested
by an eligible entity. Oh, yes. As Deb states, if requested by an eligible entity. Okay? So, in other words, another organization.
One that is not
liable. Yeah.
Yeah, one that is not potentially liable. Maybe your other coalition partner.
Yeah. So does that answer the any other questions, Nicole?
Not currently submitted online, and we'll give them a minute to clarify again if needed. Is there any other questions on the phone right now? Alright, I'm going to give another minute or two for questions, and then again just remind you that we do appreciate the feedback that you provide on these sessions. And there is a seminar feedback form online, and the link can be found either through your confirmation email or on the last slide of this presentation presented today. Additionally, don't forget to go check out the additional resources that have been posted. You may find value in them as you're putting together your presentation. And then also, we will have another Clue-In session that will be held September 30th at 10 a.m., and we encourage you to, at that point, you'll be well into your proposal process, so come in with specific questions because it will be focused on question and answer. I received confirmation that we did answer the question online, so we successfully finished that one. And I will wait again for a couple more minutes for people on the line to go ahead and ask any additional questions. All right, well, there's no shame in ending early, so I will ask EPA to provide any final thoughts or statements, and thank you all for your participation.